You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Brian Barr, one of the attorneys sitting on the plaintiff steering committee, the deal with BP is following the two-year anniversary of the disaster in the Gulf. Also today on the program, Walmart being investigated by the Department of Justice, apparently bribing is illegal, even if you do it in another country. Bradley Manning, almost 2 years in prison, a hearing today. The war on women continues by the right wing in this country. The Financial Fraud Task Force. Maybe the thing that's fraudulent is that it even exists. And most importantly, the Social Security Trustees report was released yesterday. We will have a full breakdown of what that report means. You're going to be hearing a lot of lies about it. We're going to break format today, just slightly. I'm going to bring in that interview a little bit later. We're still running on four cylinders today, not our normal six or eight. We're going to break format just so that we don't have any massive technical difficulties. Social Security trustees, every year they come out with their report on the state of the Social Security Trust and how Social Security is doing. Before we get there, there was a good piece last week in the Columbia Journalism Review where Trudy Lieberman, I think no relation to the ne'er-do-well senator, writes on the sort of ongoing attempts by the establishment media, by the establishment in this country, to portray Social Security as being bankrupt, as being in trouble, as being in crisis, as a way, and ultimately we know what this is about. We know there is over $2.5 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund. We know, because Al Gore's attempts to promote the notion of a lockbox, you all remember that, right? He was mocked mercilessly for saying lockbox. And what he was trying to do at that time was to make sure that the Social Security trust could not be raided to pay for shortfalls that came about because of tax cuts. But make no mistake, that $2.5 trillion, which is in the form now of essentially treasury bills, has just as much authority as any U.S. bond that you may hold or anyone else holds. It is actually earning interest as we speak. And so the idea that it's just a little piece of paper, they're just a bunch of IOUs. You'll recall George Bush and his stunt and his attempt to destroy Social Security by privatizing it. Went down to the basement, I think it was, of the Treasury, and stood in front of a couple of file cabinets and said, there's no money. It's just a paper. Well, yeah. Just like there's no plastic bag with all my cash that theoretically I have in my bank account sitting there with a tag that says Sam Cedar's money. No, I have a piece of paper. Or in fact, I just have a computer screen that says I have X number of dollars in that account. And it is earning interest, I think probably 0.03%, if that. But the Social Security Trust Fund earns a little more interest. So the point here is, how can the establishment in this country, how can the elite ultimately not have to pay back that money or to pay it back in a slower fashion? Social Security, by law, cannot add $1 to the deficit or debt by law. So it either, once it exhausts that $2.5 trillion, if it needs to draw on that to pay for current benefits, once that's exhausted, and if payroll taxes do not make up enough to meet benefit obligations, then benefits get cut. And so that's why we are told time and time again that it's in crisis, because essentially what they would rather do is cut benefits now so that they could draw down that trust fund in a slower rate, therefore hiding the deficit that's created by the Bush tax cuts. So understand that's the game that's being played here. Trudy Lieberman writes that for nearly three years, the CJR has observed that much of the press has reported only one side of this story. This is the Social Security story, using, quote, facts that are misleading or flat out wrong while ignoring others. Whatever the reason, ideology, poor understanding of how the program works, gullibility, or plain old reportorial laziness, news outlets have given the public a skewed picture of the financial health of this hugely important program, which is the sole source of retirement funds for millions of Americans and will continue to be for decades to come. The elite press repeatedly quotes the commentary of the devoted opponents of Social Security retirement programs, says Yale professor emeritus Theodore Marmor. But they appear unaware of how they are supporting a strategic attack on social insurance that has been going on for years. Broadcast anchors, hosts, and expert guests have told the public that Social Security is the cause of the federal deficit and have narrowly framed the possible cures. And we know this is a lie. By law, it cannot contribute to the deficit. If it did not have funds to meet current obligations, Those obligations in the form of benefits would be cut. She writes, over the decades since the passage of the Social Security in 1935, the media has used the term social insurance less and less, because that's what it is. It is not a welfare program. It is not means tested. It is not a transfer of wealth from those who have not paid in. It is an insurance program that ensures you will not be destitute in your old age, primarily. It also ensures in the event that children become orphaned or that a person becomes a widow or widower. But primarily, it is for retirement. It is social insurance. And because the media has slowly over the years, again, for whatever reason, used this term less and less, the understanding of what this program is has diminished. In 1930, the Washington Post, New York Times, and the Chicago Tribune together published nearly 80 articles with the word social insurance in the headline. In 1990, there were at most two, one in the Times and one in the Post. By then, the Cato Institute and other conservative think tanks were well on their way to changing the media's narrative and description of Social Security. This has been an ongoing process pushed by the right wing in one form or another since the passage of Social Security in 1936. In 1983, Stuart Butler, now Director of Policy Innovation at the Center at the Heritage Foundation, crafted a manifesto called Achieving a Leninist Strategy. This is Trudy Lieberman writing again. Outlining how the right could systematically attack the country's most popular social program. The document advised, and remember, folks, that for years, polling on this has showed that 70% of the American public does not want Social Security benefits cut in any shape or form. This document advised, quote, one element involves what one might crudely call guerrilla warfare against both the current Social Security system and the coalition that supports it. Butler and his co-author identified key interest groups, the young, the middle-aged, and those nearing or in retirement to target. The manifesto also described the need for, quote, an education campaign to gain the support of key individuals in the media, as well as to win over vital constituencies for political reform. And it called for exploring and formulating into legislative initiatives methods of neutralizing, buying out, or winning over key segments of the Social Security coalition. One of those methods now is, of course, when the Republicans or anybody talks about raising the retirement age for Social Security or decreasing the cost of living increases, they always say for existing retirees, it won't be an issue. For people who are 55 and over, it won't be an issue because they know that it's much harder to promote those cuts for people who are actually right in the midst of the need for Social Security. If you're in your 40s or you're in your 30s or in your 20s, you're just not thinking about it. You're just assuming, oh, I'll be one of those people who'll be a millionaire by the time I'm 65, 67. And I won't need that. And it's creating the deficit because that's what we're told over and over again, despite the fact that it cannot do so by definition. And one of the ways in which they've been buying out the media, you can always tell. You've seen those commercials during the Republican debates where they have the five-year-old kid who's saying, there's going to be no Social Security for me, whatever it is. Always paid for by the Pete Peterson Foundation, a billionaire who has attacked Social Security. It's his lifelong goal to get rid of Social Security. And so you'll see members of the media go to press junkets, to go to conclaves, trust camps, whatever it is, and they're all sponsored by Pete Peterson. And he's brought in and as an advisor. He is part of the supposed responsible set. And just on cue, the Social Security Trustees report comes out, and we see a series of mainstream media articles, Social Security's financial health worsens. Robert Pear in the New York Times, central message of the new report was the same in recent years. The two programs, of course, they've got to combine Medicare and Social Security. We do have a problem with Medicare. But it's no way distinct from the problem that we're having across the board. That is that health costs have skyrocketed and continue to skyrocket. Medicare depresses the rate of increase relative to private insurance. Medicare is a far more cheaper delivery system of medical insurance than private insurance. And so you've got to group that together with Social Security because it's much harder to make the argument when you separate them out. The report came out today, or yesterday, I should say. And from the report, at the end of 2011, the OASDI, Old Age Security Disability Insurance Program, was providing benefits to about 55 million people, 38 million retired workers and dependents of retired workers, 6 million survivors of deceased workers, and 11 million disabled workers and dependents of disabled workers. The trust fund itself is now projected to remain solvent until 2033, about 21 years from now. Now, understand when the trustees put out their report, they have essentially three projected scenarios: the low cost one, the high cost one, and the intermediate one. These are based on three different sets of projections, because they're trying to guess. They more or less know actuarially what birth rates are going to be, although that's a little bit of a guess, but they certainly know what birth rates have been in the past. So they know that the baby boomers are going to be entering and have now entered into their golden years. They guess at what wages are going to be. They guess at what GDP is going to be. They guess at what economic growth is going to be. They guess as to what life expectancy will be. And to try and get as close to the reality as possible, like I say, they have three different sets of projections: the low cost, the intermediate, and the high cost. What they basically present as the most solid projection is the intermediate one. Over the history of the Social Security Trust Fund reports, they have always used the intermediate one, and it has consistently been more conservative than reality has turned out to be. But that's fine. Better safe than sorry. So according to the trustees' report, the trust fund for Social Security in terms of being retirement insurance will run out until will be fully funded until 2035. For the disability insurance, that will run out in 2016. After that time, payroll taxes, because remember, by law, the Social Security Trust, the Social Security system cannot add a dollar to the deficit. At that time, if nothing is done, 21 years, 22 years, 23 years out in the case of social insurance, or I should say retirement insurance, beneficiaries will be paid 75 to 78% of their benefits. So we're looking at a 22% cut in benefits starting in about 2035 for retirement insurance if nothing is done whatsoever. I'm going to list off the other government programs: defense funding, discretionary spending, that are guaranteed solvent and not to add to the deficit 21, 22 years out. Here's the list. Crickets. That's it. just crickets. And I'm not even sure that's an official program. There is no government program or government spending on anything that is guaranteed 21, 22 years out. And then is guaranteed a minimum of 75% of benefits promised. Now, you should also know Social Security, just so you have a full understanding of this, because you're going to hear so much about this. And in the coming months, I don't care if it's before the election or particularly after the election, during the lame duck session, you're going to hear a relentless barrage, not just from the right wing, but from establishment liberal commentators. I hear that. I have conversations with them in the green rooms about Social Security is problematic. So I want you to understand exactly what Social Security is. No better time to do it than during this report. There are three revenue sources for Social Security: payroll contributions from employers and employees, interest earned on the Social Security Trust Fund, Treasury bond holdings, and of course the trust fund itself. That's not necessarily income. That's just there. That's an asset, $2.5 trillion. But that's earning interest. And income taxes on Social Security benefits paid by those with higher incomes. In other words, if you have a certain income in your retirement, your Social Security payments can actually be taxed. So in that sense, not necessarily means tested, but if you are of better means in your retirement, you're still not getting full benefits on Social Security. You get it, you pay taxes back. This report shows that Social Security benefits and administrative costs are exceeding the amount of payroll tax contributions collected. In other words, the amount that's being taken in from taxes on employers and employees is being supplemented by the income being generated by the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, you won't hear that second part, that it's being supplemented by the trust fund. It's just going to be, we're paying out more than we're taking in. This has occurred 18 different times since 1958. That's according to the Social Security Administration. 18 different times over the past 50 some odd years. So the panic that you'll hear in the voices of these commentators is BS. Understand that. Right now, we are at an historical low in terms of the amount of income Social Security captures. In other words, it was configured to capture 90% of the nation's income. But because so much of the money being generated in this country is in the hands of so few, it is now only capturing about 82, 83%. Of the nation's income. If you were to reconfigure Social Security taxes, instead of capping it at 110%, instead of someone paying who makes $50,000 paying 6% of their income as an employee into the system, and someone who's making $500,000 paying only 1% of their income into the Social Security, if you were to balance those two things out, we would not be able to say anything about Social Security other than it is completely solvent with 100% guaranteed benefits until the year 2085. And the only reason why we wouldn't be able to say until 2125 is because that's just simply too far out to predict what... You can't really predict what birth rates are going to be in the year 2065 with any type of assurance. Right now, the average retiree receives $14,781 a year. So no one's getting rich off this, but nearly 65% of Americans who are seniors rely on Social Security for at least 50% of their income in retirement. So you're talking about 65% of Americans who are living off of $28,000, $29,000 a year in retirement or less on average. So no one's getting rich here. So the idea of cuts are far more drastic than the idea of lifting this cap. The Retirement Research Center at Boston College estimates that nearly one half of Americans will not be able to maintain their standard of living in old age. That jumps up to 6 out of 10 when health and long-term care costs are included. So the idea that there's some fat to trim here is a joke. Another way of understanding why there's this supposed shortfall, and I say supposed only because relative to any other government program, there's simply nothing that is more assured than Social Security. Wage compensation has lagged profits in over the last decade. Wage as a share of GDP has fallen. Prior to 2000 and back to at least 1985, this is when this data was started to collect it. The ratio of wages to GDP was around 40%. By 2010, it had dropped to 37%. That's 3%. That's a huge difference when you're starting to talk about these numbers. Now, the other argument you're going to hear is this notion that we are living longer. Well, the fact of the matter is that at the age of 65, it is true that those in the upper half of the income distribution in this country are living 7-8 years longer past the age of 65 than they were 75 years ago. But for those people in the bottom half of the income distribution, they're only living 1 year longer. Now, remember, Social Security, the age of retirement is already beginning to raise. Right now, I think it's 65. When I retire in 20 years, God willing, it'll be 67. So there is not a significant bump in how much longer people are living. Again, this is just brought out as a way of not using the data to suggest that Social Security is in crisis. The same with the notion of we have less workers to support more people in retirement. That's why we have a trust fund. That's why in 1983, the Greenspan Commission under Ronald Reagan raised the amount of Social Security taxes that were being taken. This was all anticipated. People will refer to those two facts as a way of implying that there's something wrong with Social Security. But the numbers that underlie those, the actual numbers, the actual projections, prove that that's not an issue. It's already baked into the cake. So you'll hear this over and over again. This is leaving aside the notion that 70 years after the advent of Social Security, one would have hoped that we could actually progress further. In other words, there's no reason why we shouldn't make Social Security benefits more generous. There's no reason with progress that shouldn't mean that people can retire earlier. The only reason is that there are people who simply don't want to pay the traditional amount of income taxes that they've paid or they would have paid over the course of the past 100 years in this country, 75 years of this country. There's simply just more of a desire now to redistribute wealth upwards. Repealing the Bush tax cuts, only by a third would fill the so-called shortfall in Social Security. But again, I think just raising the cap is the easiest thing to do at that point. So I just wanted to make sure that we went through this report, because you're going to see headline after headline. You're going to see talking head after talking head. They are laying the groundwork to cut Social Security. And there's absolutely no reason to do it. None. And the cuts that they're projecting, to fill that shortfall now with cuts, you would have to cut Social Security starting tomorrow by 16%. None of these politicians will suggest that, because they know they're going to get a pushback. So if you start to cut Social Security, plan to do it, let's say, in 20 years, they're talking about cuts in Social Security that would be equal to, if not greater, than the actual cuts that would be necessary if nothing was done whatsoever. In other words, we're only going to get 25%, 75% of our benefits starting in 2035, 2033. The cuts that they're calling for are actually greater than the cuts that we would get if we did nothing, which is proof right there that this is not about shoring up Social Security. This is about taking pressure off the obligation to repay the money that has been borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to, we're going to play the interview that I did with Brian Barr at the Mass Tort Conference on the settlement that BP signed on to. The interesting thing about this interview is, notice that while it's being reported that the BP settlement is for $8 billion, that's simply BP's number. Nobody really knows how big this settlement's going to be in dollar figures, because all that was set up was a process. And nobody really knows how many people are going to be in the process or what the size of their claims are going to be. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Brian Barr. An attorney with Levin Papantonio, and we are talking. First off, Levin Papantonio is down in Pensacola, Florida. Brian, are you from Pensacola?
I'm pretty much originally from Pensacola. Yeah.
All right. So you live on the coast in the Gulf. So when we talk about it being the second anniversary of the BP explosion and subsequent massive oil spill, this is both a professional interests you have, and personal in some level. I mean, this is affecting you this has affected your home.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, as an environmental lawyer, I never wanted to have to practice environmental law for something that's happening in my hometown. And this spill had a very large impact on Pensacola and the entire Gulf Coast with, you know, with the impact of tourism, the impact of the seafood industry. And it's been an ordeal to work through, but I think we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel now.
And potentially the health of the residents of the Gulf Coast. I mean, I'm looking at this piece right here from Al Jazeera, written by Dar Jamil, one of the few reporters who've been continually, at least national reporters, been following what's going on with the Gulf. And it outlines the tremendous amount of seafood deformities that scientists and obviously fishermen are seeing, you know, shrimp without eyes, without eye sockets. That can't be good.
Yeah, we've seen the reports of that, and that's one of the reasons why in the settlement agreement we have worked out that we filed yesterday, shrimpers get what we call an RTP, a risk transfer premium, a really high one
Before we get into the details, let me back up for a moment and tell people that you are a member of what is known as the Plaintiffs Steering Committee. What is the Plaintiffs Steering Committee? What does it function to do? Who else is on that committee?
There are, I think there's 19 of us on the committee at this point. Then there's a four-person executive committee, which I'm on, and two people that are what we call liaison counsel, and that's Steve Herman and Jim Roy. And the court appointed us to coordinate and direct the litigation. All of the cases in federal court got transferred to New Orleans.
Now, what is the litigation? I mean, you know, because I don't think people have really, I certainly haven't been following the intricacies of what is going on with holding BP accountable. We all heard about the $20 billion, dollar settlement that BP or the agreement they made with the Obama administration.
Well, let me correct a couple of things you just said, because that's not quite right. There is no $20 billion settlement with Obama or anybody. What BP did is they went and, with a private agreement, hired Ken Feinberg. Obama gave his blessing to it. He didn't appoint him. He wasn't even Obama's idea. BP.
Ken Feinberg was the man who was hired to basically hand out the money, and then it sort of was subsequently revealed, I think about 6 months ago, that his law firm was making something like, what, $1 million?
They were making a lot of money, and he was, and the court that all the litigation is pending in found that he was essentially BP's lawyer.
Right.
And so that, you know, that's been something we'd been complaining about all along. But I think we've gotten past that issue at this point now, because the Gulf Coast Claims Facility is closed. And this new settlement opens up a new procedure that is directed by a court-appointed administrator. It's got court supervision, so we know there's going to be fairness with it. The only point I was making on the $20 billion trust is a lot of people think that that trust was put aside only to pay people for their losses, and that's not what it was. That trust was there to pay response costs, recovery costs, pay for government losses, and it wasn't this large fund that Ken Feinberg had to play with. So that's been a misconception a lot of people have had.
Okay, so who are the plaintiffs? I mean, when you sit on the Plaintiff Steering Committee, who are you representing?
We are in charge of all plaintiffs that are pending in the litigation, and that would be people that were hurt in the explosion, the guys on the rigs, people that were hurt in the response efforts, you know, the cleanup workers, the people that live on the Gulf Coast, people that suffered financial losses because of the spill, either tourism-based, seafood-based, anything like that from the moratorium. And then we've got...
How do people establish that? I mean, if I'm a fisherman or if I, let's say, owned a motel where people would come, how would I establish that? Well, or is that just sort of their blatant assumption?
Well, in a trial, it'd have to be settled through the evidence. But because we've got this settlement now, it's settled simply through, and it's kind of difficult to explain without seeing it, but we've got these zones that we've set up, economic loss zones, and depending upon the zone you're in, you have different levels of proof. Some zones don't have any level of proof. Just because you're in the zone, that means you're impacted. Then all you have to do is show what your 2010 losses are, and we've set it up in a way where you have a lot of freedom in how you show those
losses.
So the
closer, or if you're in a specific area which is known for tourism, you have a less of a burden to prove that you've lost money, because there's a basic assumption as you move out from that concentric circles or whatever it is based upon the specific region. You have more or less a burden.
And it's essentially, if you're in what we call Zone A, you don't have to show.
I understand.
If you're in Zones B, depending upon what you are, you don't have to show.
Is there any part of your plaintiff group that is also just sort of people who may suffer health consequences now or in the future? I mean, this is something that isn't always predictable. I'm thinking specifically, 9/11 first responders, they don't realize that they've got lung problems until 8-10 years down the road.
Right. We've got in our other side, we filed two settlement agreements yesterday. One deals with the economic, the other deals with the medical. On the medical side, for people that were response workers or residents in certain zones that were exposed to oil, we've got a program where they will be able to get medical care. And they will be seen by a doctor once they come into the program. And then if they develop any certain conditions within, I think it's 21 years, they can file a lawsuit against BP and proceed forward. And so this preserves that right. So we tried to take care of that person.
This is very different than what happened in the wake of the Exxon Valdez, isn't it?
It's extremely different. One of the things I think we're proudest of is we were told when this litigation got started, everybody ran around and said, what are y'all doing? Y'all should just be dealing with Ken Feinberg. Just take what you can get. You don't want to be dealing with a 25-year Exxon Valdez. And what we did is in less than 2 years from the Deepwater Horizon, we came up with a comprehensive settlement agreement that we believe takes care of everybody. And it doesn't happen unless we did what we were doing in the litigation front.
How were you able to do that? I mean, when you look at what has happened with the Exxon Valdez, they're still having problems years and years after that. Exxon seemed, as far as I can tell, to get away with a lot of stuff, not dealing with a lot of the implications of what they were responsible for. How was it that you guys were able to do this?
We put as much litigation pressure as you can possibly put on a defendant. We took 350 depositions over a period of 12 months. We developed the evidence. BP knew it was going to lose the trial. So they finally got real with the situation they were dealing with and agreed to the fairest way to take care of the issues.
So what is it that BP knew? Why did they know they were going to lose the trial? What did they know that they were going to lose? Obviously, I imagine with the settlement, there's not necessarily a lot you can talk about this. I see you smiling there. I certainly don't want to in any ways jeopardize one of this massive settlement. But
And as part of the settlement, they obviously say that they're not admitting liability and they believe they would have prevailed.
Right. I'm sure everybody who settles for this type of huge amount of settlement always feels they're going to win and then decides, we just don't want to do
it. It's just the evidence is the way they conducted their business out in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's not just BP. It's Transocean and Halliburton, and they're going to have to get realistic with their responsibility in this too, because at this point they haven't settled. And every decision they made was a money decision. We're not going to take this measure because that will cost more money. And in any one of those decisions in isolation is probably not so bad, but they made hundreds of those decisions, and they all built up to what you saw on April 20th.
And was there any the response? So we have a situation where a series of decisions which were made basically on a cost-benefit analysis, and that analysis always is, classically, is, well, it's our cost, but we can sort of push that risk off onto society. Essentially, that becomes an externality. This is how we can deliver our product and make our profits without having to absorb any of this risk. We're going to socialize the risk and privatize the profits. What about after the fact? Did they make those same type of decisions after the explosion? In other words, could they have mitigated the impact of the explosion?
I guess what I would say is I don't believe that they didn't, that they tried to cut cost in the response. I believe they put every dollar they had into it and had maximum effort in the response. I believe that wholeheartedly. My only criticism would be that they weren't ready on April 20th, and that's what slowed them down. So essentially, they had to spend a bunch of money to get up to speed to figure out what to do, and I believe they should have been ready before it happened.
So what is the size of the settlement? I mean, is there a dollar figure that you can attach to it, or is that part of the point, is that this is not capped?
It's an uncapped settlement. Now, one part of it, what we call the Seafood Fund, is a $2.3 billion fund to compensate the harvesters of seafood. And there's a lot of reasons why we set it up that way.
Why don't you call them fishermen?
Well, because it's not just fishermen.
Okay.
It's captains, vessel owners.
All right.
It's a chain of people. So that's why we say harvesters.
Who work in that industry?
Yeah. Okay. Now, but once the fish gets on shore, it's a different part of the settlement that deals with them. But we set that fund up primarily because those guys were the most impacted, and we wanted to make sure they got the most recovery. So they have higher RTPs. And so that's why it's
RTPs again?
The risk transfer premium. It's essentially a multiplier on their 2010 losses.
Okay.
But the rest of the settlement is completely uncapped. I don't know what it's worth. I know what the formulas provide for specific class members, but I don't know how many class members that are out there and what their total numbers are going to be. But BP has estimated it at just under $8 billion. That's an estimate they have to put out there for securities law reasons in London. I don't know if that's right. I suspect it's higher than that, but I don't know. And frankly, I don't care. What we negotiated was a methodology that we believe was the fairest methodology for people to be compensated. What the total number ends up being, I don't care, so long as the people are compensated.
So, and just to be clear, so this settlement is the low end. I think it's BP's not going to overstate what they think they're going to be owed, because that would not be in their interest at all.
You wouldn't think so.
The low end is going to be worth $8 billion. The number of people, in other words, the size of those people who are going to be part of the settlement, we don't know at this point. It's not capped. And nor is it capped, temporally speaking, insofar as that there could be claims that could be made. How far out?
You will have to have made a claim by April 22nd, 2014.
Okay.
Is when you will have to have made a claim. The medical thing's a little different. You still have, you make your claim, but then you have time to file a lawsuit if you develop something.
So if somebody develops something in 2015, they cannot.
If they've made a claim, they will preserve that ability to then file the lawsuit.
But they cannot make a claim before. They need to make that claim before 2015, or I guess.
Yeah, 2014.
2014. Okay, so we don't necessarily. How will we deal with if we find out in 5 years that the chemicals used in the cleanup, that the fumes in some way have caused this type of disease? Is there any type of protection?
Well, if they have specified conditions now, they make their claim, they get paid what they're entitled to.
Okay.
And then that preserves that in 5 years, if they develop something, they can file a suit.
All right. So it's in the best interest of inhabitants of that area, if you have any belief that you've been exposed to something that could cause you harm in the past, to file that claim, just so you put down a marker. Hopefully there is no long-term health implications, but if you feel you've been exposed, that's something that people should be filing, right?
That is absolutely something they should be looking at.
Okay. All right. Well, Brian Barr, congratulations. And on behalf of, people who, from my perspective, obviously, I want to see people compensated down there. I want to see that part of the country repaired to the extent that it can be. But this is also the important thing to remember. This is hopefully this in some way impacts the decision-making process of the next BP, where they say, you know what? The value, what we're going to save here is just not worth it relative to the cost that could be associated with it in the future, because that's all these people do. They just put one column up against another, and the more that they see on that cost column, the potential cost column, the more they're going to change their behavior. And that's what mass torts, I guess, is all about.
And that's certainly what we're hoping the impact of this is.
Brian Barr, thank you so much
thank
for joining
you.
Us.
It might take all the
strength I got. All right, folks. Ooh, I jumped the gun. All right, we're reversing the songs today a little bit. That's all right. All right, folks, that's our, well, the first half of our program today. The better half is coming up. You can call me at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Folks, we need your support. I've had a couple of cancellations. People are having some tough financial times out there. That hasn't changed, it seems. So if you can afford to become a member of the Majority Report, we seriously need your support. You get swag, you get extra time for the show, but the bottom line is you support the show, you make sure that first 40 minutes shows up every day. You can support the show in other ways, of course. Use our Amazon link. Go to majority.fm, click support the show, click the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon junk if you buy Amazon junk through that link. And you're supporting the show. We have merch. Get a Majority Report mug or shirt. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade, organic if you want, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get a 10% discount. Give us a review on iTunes, for gosh sakes. How easy is that? DonateYourAccount.com. We're still trailing Citizen Radio. I don't know how that's possible. Just donate one tweet a week, a day, Facebook posting, whatever. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. See you in the better half.